Welcome back to It Starts With You podcast with me, Mark Hopkins. And in this episode, I get to chat to Ben Shorter. If you remember a couple of podcasts back, I got to speak to Robbie Sturgis, who talked about training and development and the importance of it. Well, Ben was one of the key figures in that training and development and supporting Robbie in building his business. So I thought I'd have a good conversation with him. I've kind of got to know Ben through social media on and off for the last couple of years. I know his dad really well, Jeff Shorter, as well. So I always thought it'd be worth kind of getting Ben on you and giving his perspective of recruitment training for as an external trainer and what it consists of. What does recruitment look like now? What is it going to look like in the future? And what are the important things we need to know as recruiters and need to do as recruiters? And also managers as well. What are they going to do? How are they going to lead? Because times have changed. And we mention this quite a lot in this podcast. So strap in, and I hope you enjoy the ride. It's a great podcast. Catch you on the other side. Hey, Ben, how are you doing?
Mark, I'm amazing. Thank you so much, mate. How are you doing? You all right?
Not bad, mate. Not bad. Is it still raining down by you? Is it?
It's cleared up a little bit, so it's wet outside, but hopefully it'll be sun for the rest of the day.
Ah, good. Ben, do you want to tell everyone who you are and what you do?
Yeah, so my name's Ben Shorter. I build training interventions for recruitment agencies. So whether that's one-day courses or working long-term, so effectively agencies outsource their learning and development to my business.
Awesome. That's a lot to say that you're a big trainer.
it's a weird one. Like, for now, I would say we're kind of going past that point, and a lot of people don't realize this. So I did a lot of stuff outside of the industry in their personal development space.
Yeah.
So with that, I've got a team of 12 people. Wow. And now three of them are focused on, including me, are focused on this side of the business, and we're going to scale up quite quickly.
Yeah. So,
yeah, I figured out a couple of the things agencies do with factoring, and I do the same.
Ah, interesting.
So we're massively ramping up for more investment over the next year or so.
So in essence then, as a training, would you call yourself a training coordination business then, or is there something a little bit more added in there that's a bit different to the rest that's out there?
So often where we're working with smaller companies, they know that they can outsource their entire L&D function to us. That's so awesome. We can bring in people to do different types of training. So for example, I'm not necessarily a leadership expert. I've done bits of leadership training, but there are people that I can go and get that I can bring in to do that specific type of stuff.
Ah, that's really good. Because you can find with some trainers, they'll try to take the burden of that on their shoulders and then try to deliver a piece of training.
Yeah, definitely. I think this is the thing. Well, I was in the training team of the Adecco Group when it was quite a large training team.
Yeah.
I realised the best way to work was people have an area of specialty that they gravitate to.
Yeah.
So whereas I've done different training and different things, for me, like I'm a hardcore BD trainer. That's what I love the most. Okay. More so than resourcing training, more so than management training.
Yeah. We'll talk about BD training in a second, actually, because I said something on LinkedIn early on last week, and I got pulled up with it by a friend of mine called Scott, who's an internal trainer at Major Players. I'll tell you in a sec about that. So I just made a note of that. So in entirety then, so you go into a business, you deliver a package of training. What's the follow-up then? Do you come back in 2 weeks' time?
So this is the thing. We're massively geared around follow-up in our business. So sometimes we might deliver one intervention and do follow-up coaching courses.
Yeah.
And you might just deliver one bit of training, but then do four, five, six different follow-up sessions around that piece of training.
Yeah.
So for us, it's about implementation, not people clapping their hands and saying, oh, that was really good training, lads. Because that's irrelevant, really. It's about the tangible results that we can get clients that utilise us.
Yeah, because that's the important part. I remember when I was a business manager at Reed, if you weren't following up the training and you weren't working with the trainers and taking what they were doing and putting them into practice on a weekly, you know, they don't just sit a course, come back, and suddenly they're fucking brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, if you weren't doing that follow-up, And you may as well not bother to send them on the course.
So, I think this is the thing. It's what is often missing from the really big companies in terms of training. It's what trainers are frustrated about. Like, I remember being sat there and you see like a leavers list and you think, I trained that person. They were really good in the training room. Now, what's happened when they've gone back to branch?
Who do you blame for that? I know you might sound controversial, yeah, but who do you blame for that?
Sometimes it's the business not investing in the managers enough. Like, as much as I say that I'm not a good management or the best management trainer, I can deliver management training because I've managed people.
Yeah.
But the problem is where people don't know how to manage and they've not been taught how to manage. Like, I was lucky. Someone's invested in me and said, okay, let's put Ben onto a manager's course so that he's able to deliver one-to-ones in a certain way, that he's able to inspire people to take action.
Yeah.
Because the recruitment industry's changed a hell of a lot over the last like 10, 15 years.
Oh, God, in the last 5 years alone, I don't recognise some of it.
Exactly. Like, back in the day, a good manager was someone that was going to the office and saying, pick up the fucking phones and make some calls. And now you do that and people will look at you like...
Quit.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I'm gone.
Well, I used to work, I'm not going to mention their name, but I used to work for a company where the managing director would pace up and down the office in a like a weekly or monthly meeting, screaming and shouting at people, red in the face, and then would point at DVDs of Mike Walmsley, if you remember those that guy, and say, you know, if you want training, it's your fucking training. And then, you know, you've got 5-6 years experience, pointing at people, you know, you should be able to do this. And it's like, that's not how it works these days. You know, footballers still need to be coached daily, weekly to play on match day. So why aren't salespeople being coached and developed?
Exactly. And I will say this, there are certain companies that do it. Like, one of my clients has got 14, 15 people in their sales team, 14, 15 people in their delivery team, and they contract me in a huge amount of the time, and they've got an internal L&D manager.
Well, okay. So I get sometimes, because like you say, you know, you've got to bring in specialists to do certain parts, and the L&D manager's probably not a specialist in everything. But then the L&D manager should be doing the additional things to develop the support part of that training, I would presume, wouldn't you?
I think it's the thing, like with that particular situation, I probably came in before, or I did come in before the L&D manager, and I told them at one point as I was scanning up that an L&D manager would be a really good hire for them.
Yeah, sure.
And in some ways I'm lucky because it meant that I got to deliver the part of the training that I really enjoy. Oh, and good. She kind of covers everything else.
Yeah. Well, that's a good, I guess that's the thing then. You deliver your specific specialty. Because at the end of the day, you don't need to deliver the entire package, do you? You just need to deliver deliver the part that's important to deliver from someone from outside. You know, otherwise.
It's often identifying what's missing in the first place and having that perspective to say, okay, this is what I've seen work at lots of other places. Why don't you try this?
That's a really good thought, actually. So you identify what needs to happen. What is the common thing that these agencies seem to be failing at then?
It's not that they're failing. I think it's more the industry's changing a lot and they're just trying hard to keep up to the pace. Like for me, if someone's invested in training, they're at least doing something right.
Yeah.
But where the industry's moving so much and there's so much competition, you need consultants that are a lot higher quality than I ever was. Mark, I built a desk calling up companies and saying, have you got any vacancies?
Yes. I remember those days. I love those days.
Who do I speak to about recruitment?
Yeah, I know. And do you know what? There was a date. I could tell you the date that it all stopped, and that was 2009. And there was... Yeah. The recession stopped all that from happening. And in the last 10 years, every agency in this country is trying to work out how the hell to do business. Every agency I've worked for sure.
Yeah, 100%. And ironically, that was the time that I was a consultant. So I remember like that so well, making those 100 calls a day and just dialing the phone, have you got any vacancies? Have you got any vacancies? And then suddenly nothing was happening. So we were told, okay, we need to go and sell some value now.
Yes.
But not all agencies have kept up with the value piece. So I would say they have now, but where it's so saturated, Our world is insane. There's 40,000 recruitment agencies registered in the UK.
Yes.
What the fuck?
I know. Is there a need for that many? And I'm going to say, I don't know, is the answer to that question. I really don't know. I think what you find, though, the vast majority of those recruitment agencies are small, one-man bands, if not two or three people, maximum. Whereas I would say probably 10,000 to, I'd say 20,000, they're over 10 people. So the ones which are going to need the most amount of training are probably the bigger ones over the smaller ones, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, I mean, again, though, it depends on the methodology. You take, say, Robbie, for example. Those guys invested with me very early on.
Yes.
And I've had enough discussions between people that... It's a difficult one now. So obviously I'm going to say, oh yeah, people should invest in training. That's my personal bias, Mark.
Yeah, but speaking to Robbie and kind of know, I know Robbie. Robbie's another podcast for the listeners that want to hear a little bit about Robbie Sturgis's business. Ben, you went to them and developed a package of training and they grew and they're doing really freaking well as well. Robbie would say, their hard work, I'd say, obviously, their hard work and training that you provided at the same time. And Robbie's probably giggling to himself. They're going, no, Mark. but seriously, you know, and I know that he, because he early doors went, right, to expand this business, I need to do this freaking properly. So he's a good example of a forward-thinking business manager that wants to build a business from the ground up properly. So with the right training, the right development. Whereas then you'll have some agencies that'll bring in their first guy and then that first person will be probably, hopefully experienced, but they're not always. But they then press upon them their bad habits and poor methods in recruitment, but also their good stuff at the same time. So you've suddenly got this newish person into the industry and then the next person comes and that's where it cascades from there. And then they go, oh, I need a sales trainer. I've got five people now, and then they go and call you, and you go in, and you've noticed this. Literally, the bin is on fire, and and they're all banging heads against the wall because they can't get business. Is that typical, or is it more like Robbie?
I think most of the people that I work with, I'm very picky, Mark. I've been around the industry enough to know there's lots of companies that just quite simply aren't worth my time.
Yes, I agree.
I'm not going to go and sell training to someone that doesn't think training's needed. There's enough people that are forward thinking like Robin. And I think a lot of the time for me, like, clients will call me and they just want to see different contexts because they know that I know what happens in different environments.
Yes. Yeah.
So they want to know, okay, what happens in the Reeds and the Decos of the world to what happens in those companies between sort of the 30 and 100 million turnover.
Yeah.
And they want to see one so they can say, okay, I picked that, and that. That's going to work for me.
There's
often people looking for like a 10%, 20, 30% growth on a particular thing versus a complete game changer.
Does that exist though? Does a complete game changer exist? Or would you need a complete top-down change of the entire business for a game changer?
I think this is the thing, right? It's coming back to something we've spoke about before. For me, the game changer is how we utilise marketing.
100%.
The company's doing, and that's not a training issue. And I will say this, Mark. One of the first things, I talk about growth, the first thing I've invested in, I've got a meeting with my content writers tomorrow.
Oh, cool.
And it's something, it's a solution that I'll build to agencies, outsourced content.
Yeah.
They can outsource their content to my team, who aren't recruiters, they're content people.
Wow. So this is, I didn't think I'd come here with you with this, by the way. I'm a little off guard. But this is, I talk about this quite a lot with other podcast people, kind of realizing where businesses are coming, you know, where recruitment industry is going. And this is kind of everyone, because of social media, this is where we're all going. We're going down this content marketing process where, and we'll talk about BD in a second because I've got a few things I want to talk to you about BD, where the business development now is off the back of the content that you're developing. So your good old-fashioned sales funnel used to be 300, 400 cold calls a week, especially if you're starting up a desk. Now it's a little bit of that, but then it's a little bit of what your content marketing is drawn in, and then it's keeping people in that funnel for, I mean, I've got people in my funnel being in for 2.5-3 years.
Yeah.
And then suddenly they appear with a job or two, and you're like, oh, thanks. I didn't know you were still there. I didn't know you were still watching and reading my stuff. But that's you putting yourself out there in your business like all the big brands do, and it's been in that zero moment of truth, and that's where it's about, I find, on the business development side of things now.
Definitely. I think that could be the only real, like, massive game changer top-down training. And it's something that certain companies are speaking about at the moment that I have conversations with about content, because content's a weird one. Like, I will talk about the importance of doing content.
Yeah.
I've not done a huge amount of content on LinkedIn. And I was talking to someone about that. And the reality is, I was one of the trainers at a depot. The amount of people I've trained, or the amount of people that have seen me trained, it's relatively easy for me to get work to maintain myself. Now I'm scaling up and I want to grow. Now I need to utilize things like content.
Yes. You have to. But someone was saying to me the other day that they don't see the advantages of utilizing social media for their business. And I think you're right and you're wrong at the same time. I think you need a presence on social media for your marketing. You still got to get some of your guys to write some sort of blog about recruitment or something that's important to that industry. The one thing I do say that they shouldn't do, especially like my engineering industry, I don't write about engineering. I write about the problems surrounding the recruitment of engineering, or I talk about the problems with recruitment around engineering, but I never talk about engineering, if that makes sense.
Why is that?
Because a couple of years ago, I did.
Yeah.
And I sent it out to a couple of 100 managers, and the response was very negative to me, and they didn't like it. They didn't like it at all. And I remember sitting with a meeting with an engineering manager, and he said, you know, this, and I see it, and I get what he's on about, because now I'm seeing it from vendors to the recruitment industry as well. Basically, you know, great, you're telling me about that you understand engineering, but, you know, don't fucking tell me what to do, is basically what he said. And I see it. I don't see it with the trainers and people like yourself supporting the recruitment industry, because where you guys come from, it's understandable to say you need to do more retain work, or you need to do more BD, or, you know, and then you put out there a couple of pieces of content talking about that. It's the ones which are coming from CRMs, video interviewing software, and they're telling us what to do and talking about retained recruitment. And we're kind of, I've got a few good recruiters in the industry, some of the managing directors, and they're getting sick and tired of this bombardment of these companies talking about how to do recruitment when they don't do recruitment.
No, Mark, that's a really valid point, mate. Really valid point.
Yeah. That's the only thing I would say.
I think this thing, like, we can engage with our client base about how they think is best practice, or what they've seen work in different things.
Yeah.
Because I'll give you an example. Like, one of the reasons why I build quite well in industrial is because I was so used to being around production lines, I could go into a smaller company and say, you're not doing that well. Like, why don't you look at it from this perspective? Why don't you change that? And I've seen people sort of increase their production and therefore leverage me to use more temps.
Yeah.
But that was, I suppose, based on seeing different things and saying, okay, what about trying this? You're right. What we can't do is be so, like, forceful with our beliefs and think that our one size fits everyone. I think that's what a lot of trainers get wrong.
Yeah. So coming into BD then, so entering into that, this is probably going to be either a really short conversation or a really big one, actually. Because I'm from the old school recruitment. I started recruitment in 2005. So I've been in this game for quite some time now. And I was taught the 100 calls a day, kind of smashing the phones. Literally what we were saying to anyone, like saying, have you got any jobs? And you would pick up jobs. And engineering, and manufacturing, you would always pick up jobs. It's filling them was the nightmare part of it. And that's when I realized that it wasn't really about picking up the phone. It was more about how you sell yourself. But anyway, that's a different matter. Are you finding that when you have companies coming to you, agencies coming to you, if they believe that's what the market is.
I've seen KPIs change so much, Mark.
Okay.
Like, for me, good clients that I work with, the KPI in between sort of 20 to 50 sales calls, so speaking to a decision maker a week.
Yeah.
And most are probably closer to sort of that 20, 30, 40 mark than they are to what I saw back in, say, 2009 and 2010, which is more like that 100 mark.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like the volumes change between good accompaniments.
Yeah. But are they getting, is the conversion ratio then, are they still getting jobs from those calls? Or
I think it comes down to the types of calls that they have. Like, I've seen, like, I don't go with the old school of expectations that you see on Reed, you can earn 100 grand in your first year, that type of shit. Yeah. That's all a load of rubbish.
Yeah, I agree.
I've seen trainees go from zero to having a 10, 15K a month desk over the course of a year by making good BD calls. So, for example, at first they'll develop a candidate pool. They'll get really good at filling jobs. And then once they learn a candidate pool in the marketplace, they take that candidate pool to the marketplace. So where every first call is a spec call, or most places will candidate call, whatever other buzzword we want to bloody call it, that marketing a candidate to a company. And then they follow up on that. And they follow up by giving value.
Got you. Are you finding that the marketing a candidate to a company, is this just a really good profile of the candidate, or are they, or is this the CV send, spec send that people don't like, as in managers don't like, I should say?
So I think it's the thing, it kind of depends on how it's utilised. Often the guys that I'll say, yeah, engineering managers won't necessarily like it because it's what they'll see. But yeah. If they see a good candidate, they're more likely to have a conversation with someone than if they see a shit candidate.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the problem. It's just the blanket shit that's put out there.
Yeah. And so for me, like, before I even send that candidate on, I need to know, okay, what candidate or what value is this candidate going to be? And I want to be, like, realistic like that. So a lot of the time, say I'm sending you a CNC miller. Mm. Now, first of all, I've made sure that I know that the types of CNC machines that you're using are similar to ones that he's used before. You use fanuc controls, he uses fanuc controls.
Correct.
I don't know anything else. So I send that in and say, oh, this is the type of candidates that I work with on a regular basis. How do you tend to find your candidates? What recruitment process do you have?
Yeah.
So it's not like, oh, this is the best fucking candidate you're ever going to see, Mark. You need to take him now because he's got 10 interviews lined up. Is this the type of person you have? Am I right here? Do you want to speak with me more about it? And it's just them maintaining the level of contact where I'm consistently giving value to you.
That's really good. That's exactly how I do it, admittedly. You just give away all my secrets. But that's, I mean, Mitch Sullivan used to call it horse trading. But I'll be honest with you, that's kind of how the marketplace should kind of work for agencies in the most, is that you identify good people, you take them to market, especially in a candidate dry market or candidate driven market. And there's plenty of jobs out there, but you need to identify the right companies to put these jobs in. It's how you do it is the professional part of it. So if you're just banging out 200 fucking CVs a week, spec sending to people, and then expecting that to, and call that recruitment, and expect people to pay 15% for that or 20% for that, then you're going to find very hard to do recruitment. You really. Yeah. But then on top of that, then there's all the content marketing stuff. So it's kind of like this double kind of bubble of business development, really, isn't it? Whereas, is the cold calling still working? That's the big question.
I think it depends what people mean by a cold call. Now, to me, a cold call is me calling you. I've not spoken to you before, Mark.
Mm.
That doesn't mean I don't know stuff about your business. Doesn't mean that I haven't done my research.
Yeah, yeah. I get what you're saying. So they've got to do research then. Is that what you're trying to get to?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, not overthink it though. Well, when I say research, the problem is, and I'll say this, if I'm working with trainees, people very new to the recruitment industry, first thing I want to do is get them on the phone and get them used to being on the phone.
Yeah.
Because I know, oh well, where people go wrong in this industry early on Is I not on the phone enough? Hmm. They come to resent it. They want to hide behind emails and things like that. Therefore, they are going to struggle billing over a longer period of time than someone that's able to have a phone conversation, at least based on how the market is right this second.
Yeah, I get that. I get that. What I used to do with those guys is just get them speaking to candidates all the time.
Yeah,
just
100%. I don't know if this is something we'll probably talk about more, but I don't know if you saw my post at the beginning of the year in having a bit of an argument with someone.
For me,
people shouldn't go into business development without resourcing first.
Oh, 100%. You shouldn't be dropping them in the deep end with business development. Because my theory on this one is these people are representing your business to other companies, selling your product, which is obviously recruitment services, to other companies. And they're 10 minutes in recruitment. What form of knowledge or authority are they coming from?
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, at least if they've spoken to 20, 30 candidates and the manager says, well, I am looking for this type of accountant. And they go, oh, yeah, I've spoken to people that can do that. I know a few. You know, they can talk from some sort of authority then. I hate people that do that, by the way.
It's the thing, like, it was a conversation that me and Robbie had really early doors, was my expectations that people should always resource first. Now, I see it different marketplaces. Doesn't need to be that someone resources for 6 months before hitting the phone.
Yeah.
But they need to have spoken to a good 20, 30, 40, 50 candidates in detail before they speak to a client.
I agree. 100% agree. 100% agree. I've got so many questions around that, by the way. I mean, all right, here's one big question, right? Your mm-hmm. first ever BD call in a recruitment agency, right? Who should be doing it? Should it be you, the manager, or the trainer?
It doesn't really matter, to be honest. I think as long as a BD call's been well structured, it can be anyone. Like, I've worked in enough environments where, I will say this, Mark, I'm not scared to go on the phone.
Yeah.
I have no issue cold calling people. It's something I still do.
Yeah.
But when I was in different companies, say, for example, I was working for the Echo Group, Office Angels didn't want me to show people how to do calls by me doing it first, because
wow.
then it's like, then it's because I'm almost faking my brand to a point. So imagine you're the company at the end of it. I've called in. I've specced a brilliant candidate to you. I've done it in a technically really good way. I've been very concise with my elevator pitch. I've then opened up the questioning. So you're telling me about your candidates. And then you look at my profile and you see that I'm the trainer at the Adecco Group. So you're just a role play situation, really.
I got what you're saying. I mean, I'm thinking internal trainers could do that.
Okay. Yeah.
I think they could probably do that. Or the manager.
It depends on the brand that they have. Whereas the manager, I think, should do it.
I understand. I used to do it. I used to do it in front of trainees.
My manager taught me how to sell in my, like, first more client side recruitment job. She'd pick up the call, she'd make the first call, I'd make the second, she'd make the third, I'd make the fourth.
That's good. That's really good. And I think that's how then you kind of break that kind of cycle of staring at the phone with a list of people going, oh, no, I won't do that person. No, I'll do the next person. You know what I mean? And they start then running down this list of excuses of why not to pick up the phone to that person in the hope they find the easiest call on that list.
Exactly. And I think what works for bigger companies, depending on how people manage, because this is probably a separate conversation, like, how much should learning and development manage someone in their early career versus their manager? But say, for example, okay, you've got a group of 5-10 trainees come on at once. You can get them all on the phone together and they're likely to have fun with it. It's something that all of my clients are saying, including like Robbie, when they've hired a group of people, it's very easier to stop that sort of fear of calling, because you turn it into a bit of a game.
Yeah, I got you saying. Moving from the new people into more experienced people in the game,
mm-hmm.
are you coming across, are companies coming to you and saying, right, I've got a load of experienced people, but they just seem to be doing F all, what can you do with them? Are you seeing that happening?
Sometimes, and it kind of depends on how the company is structured. So there's sometimes this big fear of you've got someone on a quarter of a million pound desk or a third of a million desk,
right?
But they're just out managing everything now.
100%.
They've not done a sales call in the last 5 years.
Yeah, yeah. I could rant about top billers all day, but my whole thing about top billers is if you're sitting on a desk and you're getting work given to you and you're making a lot of money from it and you're doing very little BD, if not zero BD, you're not a top biller, you're an account manager now. But well done for getting there, because I'm sure you put a lot of hard work into it. But
I think this is the thing. Sometimes it is the company's expectation that's like at fault when they look at experienced billers. Like, hang on, this guy worked 70 hours a week for 10 years, smashed it. And yeah, now he's on a £500,000 desk. He's making 100K a year and he does fuck all in the office.
Yeah.
But he's earned the right to do that. Because all of these accounts that you as a business would not have if that person wasn't sitting in that desk right now.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it depends on how the company build it out. Companies can encourage people to grow and do more things, or they can structure it in a way that if that person was to leave, they wouldn't take their entire desk away.
It's on the same theme, but do you think when they start employing experienced people and then they have that, I've seen it happen. I think it's even happened to myself, where you start a new job, you're experienced, but then you have that 3 or 4 months of like, ugh, and it doesn't quite work out, or it doesn't quite come together. From my perspective, or from my experience, it's that company trying to make me do their KPIs. That's where it went wrong for me. So you're trying to entertain those KPIs and still try to do what you know what's best at the same time.
I think that this is the thing, and honestly, Mark, this is what I'm selling against at the moment. I've got meetings with people this week about it, where they said about paying a rec fee. Just because someone's been successful somewhere else doesn't mean they're going to be successful for you.
Yeah.
And you've got to change some of your internal processes to allow for someone external to be successful. Because this is the thing, it's exactly that. At the end of the day, I will say this, when I was billing in industrial recruitment towards the end of my career, like doing industrial, I didn't have to pick up the phone and do a lot of stuff. Like, I got a lot of stuff inbound to me. I could then divvy it up with a resourcer and get most of my jobs filled, and I could be relatively quite laid back about it. Now, if I then took that same approach into another company, I wouldn't be as successful in the first 3, 4, 5 months. And I think sometimes that's what happens with experienced hires. They think, okay, oh, I don't need KPIs, but they're going into a place that's now a cold desk. Yeah. Unfortunately, you've got to do a little bit of activity.
Oh, God, yeah. And I mean, when I started my own business, I was so used to starting desks for other people. When I started my own business, my mindset was in the desk starting world. You know what I mean? It was you know. And then I thought to myself, and this is a good question to ask you, actually. I thought to myself, right, how long is it going to take before I make my first placement? Then how long is it going to be until I make the second? And then how long is it going to be the third? And then how long is it till I start norming and making them every month?
Yeah.
And there was this difference, you know, the storming, norming, performing kind of different stages. From the past, whenever I started a company, there was this, right, you're experienced, you've made money before, right, you should be smashing it in the first 3 months. And yeah. I'm thinking, well, the first 3 months, I've just established enough communication with maybe 6 or 7 companies to get jobs off them.
Yeah.
You know, some people will make a placement in that time. I started my business, I made one in the first 6 weeks, but it was another 3 months before I made the next one. You know what I mean? And then it started norming after about 11, 12 months. So for me, I think the first 9 months, even if you're experienced, I think mostly if you're experienced, if you're a trainee, it's a different process. But I think the first 9 months in the company is crucial. Is the time before you start.
Definitely. Like, if I look at, say, me bringing on board my first proper salesperson, a selling training. So Liz started with me in July. Now, Liz has been working in IT recruitment since the 90s.
Mm.
She's seen it all, Mark.
She's been there.
Yeah. And this is what I did. I went and got some really experienced people around me. I got my dad involved as well. People that are very experienced. If she makes money in her first 6 months, I would be over the bloody moon. Like, for me, it's for an experienced person, they should be breaking even, hopefully by month six, and then by the end of the first year, start to be profitable.
Yeah.
I think that's how businesses should look at it as well. Something I said to Robbie as well, with trainees, even with experienced people, you can't expect some, at the end of the day, for an experienced person, you're going to pay a premium, so that cost of breaking even is going to be more than is a trainee.
Yeah. Yeah. But then you add all the training and the costs on top of that.
Yeah.
Then, you know, they're all kind of falling in about right. But do you think then that an experienced person needs as much guidance and development in the first 9 months as a trainee?
Not necessarily the same development. Like, I'll give you an example. So with one of my clients, I was recently running a business development academy.
Yeah.
Now, at the same time, they brought in someone who was probably 2-3 years of experience, where it was the other guys on the course had, well, they had no client side experience. One had been resourcing for a couple of years, the other one had been resourcing for 6-7 months. So with him, the training was almost optional, as in, this is what training we do. Where do you think your weaknesses are? Or what would you like to see from us? But equally, there was, this is what we expect from a business development call.
Yeah.
I don't know what your last companies were like, but this is our expectations.
Yeah.
So then these people need to be told, okay, this is what our expectations are. How can we then support you to deliver that? What training do you need? What coaching do you need? Because again, I will say this, Mark, and I'm probably bad as a trainer for saying this, training is probably worth 10% of someone's development.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
The coaching that they get from their manager and the coaching that they have from their peers, that makes a difference.
Yeah, I agree. 100% agree with you there. From over the years, I found people that have had experience and the ability to sell something, when they get into recruitment with the right guidance, they don't need that much training, because it's then, you know, recruitment's not stupid. You know, how can I put it? Recruitment is such a logical process. You speak to a company, you get a job off that company, then you go and find that candidate in whatever methodologies you want to, and then you fill it. That's the process. That's how it works. An intelligent person can work out how that works. You've just got to give that intelligent person a little bit of feelers around how to do that, how to write better copy, how to say something a little bit different to normal sales calls, and so they get it. So like you say, it's just 10%. The bit, it's that person that takes it the 90% of the way. But also, I believe that a part of that process is the company and the managers and the support and the coaching they get on top of that as well. And real coaching, not sitting at a desk saying, can you do more calls, please? That's not coaching.
definitely. I think this is the thing. I will say this probably. People don't pay me for the classroom stuff. That's not their main focus. It looks cool, but it's more, okay, what's your process for a good spec call? How do you then explain that to someone else? How do you document it? How do you then implement it? And how do you give them feedback for that?
Yeah. That's good. Yeah, and feedback is important. How you give the feedback is important.
Exactly. And it's being able to position, okay, when someone does well, how to get them to build on it. When someone does shit, how do you then use that to push the person? Because again, management is all individual. There are people, for me to get the most out of them, was me going back to like 80s boiler room recruitment and just shouting at them.
Yeah.
There's a person in my team. If I want more out of them, I just need to go and say fuck a lot in front of them and do the red face thing. And the next thing I know, they bloody sell.
Yeah.
Because that they like proving me wrong. And the reality is, they're not proving me wrong, because I trust them to sell. I know they're going to sell. They know they're going to sell inevitably. That's what they do. Pest.
I used to have this recruiter, temps consultant. And the only way to get her to she was having down days, and then the only way to get her back up to doing things, I used to have to do speeches. And in the end, I had to read about other like famous people's speeches and try to modify them in such a way that it would help her think.
I have a dream.
Yeah, that sounds not joking either. It's kind of like, yeah, it's giving them that kind of like thought process to motivate themselves. Oh my God, you're right, Mark. Yes. I can do this. And that was what it's like. Once a month, I had to do one of those little speeches.
But it was a part of the coaching of her, part of that process with that particular person. It was, I found that quite funny. But that's the important part, isn't it? Everyone's different. Everyone
100%.
You can't just one size fits all for every person in your business, can you?
No. And I think that's why, in some ways, good management training is more important than good sales training. Because probably my biggest challenge that I will have is I'll teach someone how to sell, and they won't be managed appropriately.
Yeah. Because there is, when I got into management training, I was taught, though Reed taught me, it was a company called Silent Edge that taught my management training. And they did loads of different companies from British Gas all the way through to Virgin and a few others. I think we were the first recruitment agency they did.
Yeah.
And I had never done management training where I think it was a 5-day course. On the first day, she literally ripped us apart. Everything we knew about it was like joining the Marines where they pull you down and then build you back up. And I felt awkward. I felt horrible. I felt it was just, I wanted to go away and cry after the first day. It was that hard. By the end of the week, I was freaking loving it. Absolutely loved the theories and the understand, you know, things, different methodologies, different ideas, incorporating NLP into things. And I absolutely loved it. And then I went and read a load of books, which is like, if anyone knows me, I don't go read a load of books about management. Trust me, it's normally about spaceships or something. That's what I normally do. But getting your managers to think like that, that's I think, is the key to developing your business.
Definitely. Get managers to understand, okay, how to be like a true leader in a business, how to really lead a team. Because it's funny, like a decade sent me in a really good management course. That sounds quite similar. I think mine was 3 days long and it had a million different exercises. At one point, we were running a restaurant, like craziness. It was awesome. But from that, it really made me look at, okay, the commonalities between all the best managers that I've seen.
Yeah.
And often it was an understanding of what they could do to get the most out of me. What were my drivers and how can they push me to do it? Like, how can they hone in my drivers to push me to get the result that they were being asked to get off me by their managers?
Yeah. Yeah. I see what you mean. I found back in the day where we were getting all that training, the people above us wasn't. And their mentality didn't change. And I felt that that's where the problems are. Is there a way that senior people can get that kind of management training as well? Is there like, you know, you've got business managers or team managers, then you've got the next level, and then you've got the next level.
I think it's really down to the companies and companies' owners to figure out what development's needed for them. Like, I will say this. So out of the team of 12, there's one person younger than me and my business partner. Everyone else is older than us. We've gone and got surrounded ourselves by people with a lot more experience than us. We still spend money on us going on training courses to develop us. Now, if a business has lost that, that's up to them. And it's kind of up to them how they deal with it. Like, I've seen it before with companies I've worked with in the past, where their managers or the owners aren't so much interested in training, they're not interested in their development, but they let me get on with it. They would utilise my expertise and say, okay, this isn't something that we want to go on ourselves, but run with it then.
Yeah, I got it.
That's fair enough. Whereas, like, I'll say this much, there are some people in the recruitment industry that probably the best thing they could do for themselves and for the recruitment industry is leave the recruitment industry.
I've said this a few times to a few people, believe it or not, and I think some seniorish people within the recruitment industry are so out of their depth now because they haven't moved with the times themselves. They haven't sat on some of the courses just to understand what's going on. And so, I'm going to say this out loud, fuck it. There are people in big companies that haven't picked up a phone, done recruitment for 20, 30 years, some of them. And they're giving the people below them information or orders to do certain things and upping KPIs and changing targets without understanding what the market is actually doing. Like
100%. There are people so far removed from what it's like to be a recruitment consultant that they really have no place within the industry anymore.
And
I think it's the thing, something that, like, I won't lie, Mark, I invest in recruitment agencies now. So for me, I have to sometimes, like, be at the front of desks and know exactly what's going on, knowing the types of calls and making sure those calls are effective, because otherwise I won't get paid from it. Like, rather than me charge for training, I own dividends. I'm waiting for dividends. So it's up to me to get someone really profitable.
Yeah, that's right.
And with that, I need to be aware of what is happening on desk at any point. Where's the shift in the marketplace? What did that person say to the client that made them book?
Yeah.
Because if I don't know that, I can't replicate it. And I know that the industry will change again and again and again. That's what happens. That's how industries work. The industry is going to change over the next 3, 4, 5 years. Brexit's going to have an impact. Content marketing will probably be utilised more.
I think this is the problem when you're sitting in a desk with a group of people around you that you're paying to do a job. If you don't understand how they do their job, then your business is not going to advance forward, and it's not going to do what you think it's going to do. And then you can sack as many people as you want and churn as many staff as you want out the door. It's ultimately down to you on why that's happening as a business owner. And this, it's something, luckily I don't have that problem just yet, but it's something I'm starting to spot with people that do have that problem.
No, definitely. And I think it's the thing is, owners can mitigate that by staying relevant. They don't have to go and do the same KPIs, but they should know what people are saying on the phone. And I will say this as well, like, times change. Some of the best managers I know in recruitment are shit on the phone. And the best thing they could do for their company is never make a sales call again.
Yes.
But they're really good at managing people. Let them do that.
Yeah, and that's the thing. That's a good lead on, actually, to managers. Should managers be billing, or should they just be like football coaches and support and develop people all day long?
You know what? It's a really, really, really difficult one. Like, it's something me and my business partner have conversations about, because me and him are the two people that sell the most in our business.
Yeah.
But it's also very difficult to manage people and to bill at the same time, because one will give. And one always gives. It's either the money that you're generating or your ability to be a good manager for staff.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think what I see, like, certain companies do well is where a billing manager will make a couple of sales calls, but that's more as a result to show the people they're training. And then those people will often, they'll work on clients together.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's
how I was a consultant. So my manager would work on clients with me. She'd come to visits with me, not all the time, and particularly only when I needed the more development. But we would do sales calls together. We'd split on clients.
Yeah. I've outside of the recruitment industry, because I do sales engineers, so I get to see it from other kind of perspectives in sales and kind of how it works. And I've got one client that absolutely to the letter follows Simon Sinek's Leaders Eat Last. You know that book?
Yeah, it's a great book, Mark. Great book.
And I'll be honest with you, I love that book, for the sense of which is that you've got to feed your people everything you've got. And then, you know, if you have to go and do that business development meeting or wherever it is, and then you get the work on, give it to someone. Don't you work it, or work it as a project with other people, but try to step back and let them thrive from it and build from it. And I'm a believer in that in the recruitment industry. So when I see it actually in action in outside the recruitment industry, in engineering companies and sales teams and within these companies, and then I come across the ones then that don't do that, and the manager has a sales target, and then their sales engineers have sales targets as well. What I see there is a massive churn of staff, or a massive disjoint, or a lot of finger pointing, a lot of blame as well as that's happening. And it's seeing it from the outside and hearing people's stories about, you know, you speak to candidates all day long, so you get to hear these stories. I find it fascinating. And when I reflect back into the recruitment industry, and I see it on LinkedIn as well, there's still this stigma of managers billing, or the ones that don't bill, are seen as kind of like, you know, literally like in the Invasion of the Body Snatchers, they're pointed at as like, you know, in such a weird way. I believe that you don't need to be a manager with a sales target. You need to be a manager that can bring business to the table, but then put it into their team and enrich their team from that business.
100%. Like, you should have a target for your team, and that's what I've seen work well. So you've got a team of two consultants. Between the three of you, you should get to X amount.
Yeah, yeah.
And what will naturally happen is the manager is invested in getting to that amount without thinking that, without them being pressured in terms of their remuneration. Because this is where it gets difficult. As a manager, you want to be treating people well. You're going to occasionally take people out for lunches and shit like that.
Yeah.
Suddenly, if your wages are based on commission from clients that you've got to get yourself, you're going to be selfish and you're going to try and enrich your pockets first sometimes before your team, unless you're really that sort of management focused as a person, which yeah. I have seen. Well, I've seen that enough times. I've seen people whose team do very well because of how generous they are.
Yeah.
But if you're paid a good salary and your bonus is based on your team performance, that would mean that you would naturally give stuff out. You would push the salespeople to perform more. And therefore, as a unit, you'd probably generate more money than if you were focused solely on your own personal target.
This is it. And I think this is actually linked to the, like we were saying, how the recruitment industry has changed in the last 10 years and the way that we market our businesses with more social media and content and doing more video and like this podcast, like this as well. You know, as a team then, you're going to get business from companies, not because you picked up the phone and did a cold call, but because the business itself exists and puts out the sphere of influence of who they are. So then the business reaps the reward from it, not just an individual. And I think as that continues happening into the future, we're going to have to see more of those team targets or team-based, would you say, target?
Yeah, definitely. You'd have a team who's got this financial target. Marketing would have a target based on what they're doing in terms of content. Okay. I think this is where the best recruitment businesses, in terms of the most profitable, have done really well, is they have very clear profit and cost centers.
That's a really good point.
So everything, and it's something that is measured in my business. So it's how productive is a person, how productive is a team, and what's the most productive team?
Yeah.
Because it helps. Me and my business partner, we're both competitive as fuck.
Yeah. Yeah.
We've got a bet on as to who can generate the most money like across the next years. Whose team can do £1 million a year first?
Yeah. I bet your dad Jeff is the referee in this.
So sometimes he.
Yeah. I can imagine him doing that.
I think that's why he joined our business in a way, because he was looking at doing different things and saw how me and Simone treat each other in terms of our competitive spirit. The fact that we want to open up more things. The fact that we massively reinvest back in our business.
Oh, I think that also is important. As you reinvest back into the business, you don't only just grow the business, but you enrich the business with more things, more education, more knowledge, more just better working environment as well. I guess the last question to ask you, Ben, what's the future of recruitment looking like? What do you perceive it? Which way is it going? Is it going to be content marketers and videoers and that type of thing? YouTubers, Instagrammers, or what's it going to look like?
It's going to be a mixture of both. Now, there will be a kickback against automation because people still want that consultative service.
Yeah.
So there'll be people utilising content and sales funnels more. Facebook advertising is going to go massive in terms of our industry. And yeah. I still don't get why people aren't doing it at the moment.
I don't know. I think, you know, when you go and buy a package from JobSite or Reed, it's all there and contained and all in one place. So then you've paid for it and off you go. With click per, what's it called?
Cost per click.
Yeah. That's it, cost per click. It's an unknown quantity. And I came across this with an electronics company 2 years ago who were utilizing Indeed to advertise their jobs and the cost per click kind of CPC kind of model. And she said one job, they found a guy within 40 quid. And then another job, it was $7,500 of advertisement, and they still didn't find the guy. Which, when they worked it out, it was cheaper to go to use an agency, hence why we were having that conversation. And then the more I kind of look into it, and I had a go at Facebook advertising, it got out of control. It got out of hand after 3 or 4 weeks. If you do it right, you don't... Well, start again. If you do it cheaply, you don't get the audience.
Yeah.
If you do it expensively, it got out of hand. You know, it was £400-£500 after a week, and it still didn't deliver what you wanted it to. Whereas then the good old-fashioned, chuck a proper advert on job site, read on your website, go and do some headhunting and sourcing. Obviously, it depends what sector you're in. It was a known quantity. We're quite comfortable with that. And I think this is the problem. Because there are known quantities and we don't know how to say to clients, right, if you want us to find this person, we're going to have to charge you £2,000 in Facebook adverts. We're not there, I think.
I think this is the thing. So it comes down to how you use Facebook ads, first of all. Like, I think, and this is probably the biggest learning that I've got coming from a different industry in terms of Facebook ads.
Yeah.
In terms of what my business partner does, Facebook ads is a must. We've been spending probably in the region of between 10 and 20 grand a year for the past 3-4 years. On Facebook ads, it's standard in the personal development world.
Yeah, that's good.
That's just to build a brand. Like, there are people like running some of the biggest conferences in the UK that will drop 50 grand on a conference because they'll know that overarchingly it'll be profitable for them. So you have to go in with a realistic budget and think, okay, what I want Facebook ads to do is build me a passive candidate pool that position that see me as an authority in a marketplace, and I'm going to give away something that I'm going to do, Mark, so I hope I don't get copied as a result of this. I'm going to build a funnel for people looking to join the recruitment industry,
right.
So first of all, they're going to get targeted with 5 different videos about why a job in sales could be for them, and then it's going to be a checklist on how to get your first job in the recruitment industry.
Good. Yeah, we need that.
Now, suddenly, I've got people that want to join recruitment businesses. So I build up that pool. I reckon it probably cost me somewhere between £1 and £6 per CV that I get from it. So I can do it in the localized areas. And then what I'm going to do is just market that to companies saying I've got training recruiters.
I like that. That's a really good idea, actually. So as a rec to rec, you could be doing that.
Yeah, 100%. And people, but this is the thing, it comes down to how good you are at targeting and what, and you've got to think about in the midterm. A Facebook ad won't fill a job that you've got on your board right now, Mark.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it will never do that. But what it does, it's to engage a very niche, passive audience that you're positioned as an expert. So when they're on your mailing list, they're seeing your stuff pop up. Because that's what happens. You draw someone in, they download your thing, and then suddenly you've got their email address and contact details, so you can message them. If you pick up a phone to them and you call them and say, "Hi, I'm Ben from GTX," they already know who you are because they click into your mailing list.
Interesting. I never thought of it like that. And that actually makes more sense than posting your bloody jobs on there as adverts.
Exactly. So you want to build a very specific candidate pool from them. So say you're looking for engineers, you write something about that eventually leads into how to get a better job within engineering.
Yeah, yeah. Or do a video around, I mean, I've got loads of videos that talk about, you know, applying for better jobs. And post, I think I posted one and I think I had like 50 people join my group, but I didn't have an end game. I didn't understand what I needed to do with this advert. It was me telling it. But you need to,
A company that I've bought a percentage of and I've paid over the odds for it, but they've got 50,000 Facebook likes and I have no idea what to do with them. Now, for someone like me, Facebook likes are awesome.
Yes.
Because it means that I can get a lower cost per click.
Yes. Yeah. But then it's what you do with it.
Exactly.
This is a problem. This is a problem.
And I think this is the thing. So recruitment's going to see more people like me coming into it and doing startups and looking to scale stuff. So there's going to be a sort of insurgence of millennials that know that they're not going to make money straight away. Yeah. They're going to try and build something to exit.
Do you know, that's one thing that I actually find with a lot of, I know we talk about millennials. I just think it's just a group of youngsters at this moment in time that's trying to get into the marketplace. Their mindset has changed. It's different to how, when I was in 2005 starting recruitment, my mindset was, I'm going to make a load of money in this game. This is what I'm going to do. And then the reality set in about 2 or 3 years later that you're not going to make a lot of money. It's going to be a moderate amount of money. And then one or two out of 500 of you are going to make £1 million. It's not, you know, most recruiters probably make about 100 grand. You know, that's probably where the figure tends to lie with permanent recruitment. And then I don't know what it is with temp. It's up and down these days, probably a little bit more than that. But I think that's the reality. And especially hearing companies like, but I work with SSG, hearing them and hearing the people that are starting businesses making as much money as they are in agencies, as in physically taking home much money, but doing half the amount of billings and are happy and have this lifestyle that are completely different. And I think that's what's changing in this game, is that realization that, you know, you could be the recruitment version of Uber, basically.
Definitely. I think this is the thing, though. Like, even with that, I met these two guys that started their own business for that exact reason, to start a lifestyle business. So they thought exactly like that. If we worked half the time and build half the amount of money, but it's for ourselves, we would do really well.
Yeah.
And they now have a 40 million turnover business. Yeah. And they kind of got abandoned. It's just because they're really good at servicing candidates. And I think this is the thing for where I fucked up, was I was so impatient and thought, okay, I'm going to make loads of money quickly. Whereas for me now, if I can be where my dad is, but 15 years earlier, that would be amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, dad did really well, though, didn't he?
That's almost sort of transferred into sort of my goals, because I went into the recruitment industry to make money. That's how I got involved. I saw my dad do it. I worked for him and his mate back in 2005, ironically, resourcing. So when I was 17, and then went to uni and I went to make money. And to be fair, recruitment's given me a really good lifestyle. I've never made 100 grand in a year, like personally. I've never done six figures, but I've made an average of, I don't know, 50, 60, 70 grand a year for most of my working life since I was, I'm 31, since I was early 20s. I get to DJ in and spend all of my money running drum and bass events. That's what I randomly did, and it gave me a lifestyle that I really enjoy without making me filthy rich. I don't have a sports car. I don't have a mortgage on a big 5-bedroom detached house.
This is where it's changed, isn't it? I'm 40, I worked in a company where the top billers drove Aston Martins. You know, it was that much money they were making. They're making fucking tons of money. And I don't think they're making half as much money today as they used to. But I've never met a recruiter that drives an Aston Martin. There's one in, like I say, there's one in 500 you'll see
driving. So I think this is the thing. I've been really lucky to be around those top billers. There's a 26-year-old, one of my clients, who has a contract desk doing between 80 and 120K a month.
Wow, that's
It's fucking insane, Mark. Absolutely insane. Yeah. Now, I will say this, he works really fucking hard for that. He's just running around going to meetings all the time in different countries. He doesn't switch off from recruitment. And so, and I've met probably about, I don't know, 10 of these million-pound billers. And all of them, they are different. They're just, they do work really bloody hard for it. But you're right, years ago, in the 90s and 2000s, some of the stories of what people made, it doesn't happen now.
It doesn't. And I think it was James Kahn wrote a blog about 2 or 3 years ago, and he was saying, you know, averagely, you're lucky to get between 6 and 8 grand a month from a perm consultant, and probably about that much from a temp's desk, because it does get to a point of plateau. They can only manage as much, depending obviously on how
they think. I think it depends on the resources that a company have to go for it. Like, I see a couple of like 150k, 200k, 250k pound billers.
Yeah.
And they've been given a lot of resources to enable them to achieve that.
Yeah.
And I think this is the thing. Sometimes, as well, it depends on a company's culture. I would say this, like Office Angels in London, they've got this office, and I guarantee any second of the day I went in there, about 70% of the people on the phone.
Like, yeah.
Culturally, it was like that. It was a proper high-performance like place. You would leave the office at 7, 8 o'clock. Like, there are people drinking in the kitchen from probably about 6 to 9 o'clock most evenings. But then people were still doing bits of work as well.
Yeah.
But everyone in there billed a lot of money. So that they had these five girls between the ages of sort of 25 and 30 billing about, I don't know, £1.8 million a year on perm between the five of them. Like, they're 300-400k billers.
Yeah.
But they all did probably 100 really good spec calls a week. And also, I'll say this, they all had resources as well. You had that support there.
Yeah, and that was the thing back then, because even when I had a big desk, I had resources helping.
Yeah, and this is the thing. You need often to create sort of, like, for example, every £1 million biller that I know has a team that support them to bill £1 million, whether that is resource support. So the 80 to 120K biller probably hasn't sourced a candidate for that in maybe 2 or 3 years.
Which, when you think of it like that, that's where it's all changed then, hasn't it? Because when you go into a company, you haven't got a resource support anymore.
I think this is what is needed. One thing that I will sell in is that a company should always have a delivery resource team. Now, often, say, for example, you're a small engineering company, you bring on three people. They're your three resources, and then two of which decide they want to start doing BD, one of which decides they just want to go and find CVs for you.
I agree with this, yeah.
Now, that person, me and a very big IT recruitment agency were having this conversation. So, like, well, what is the gross profit then of that person? Is everyone less productive than they used to be? In some ways, yeah, they are. Like, they have to be. You can't make what you made in the 90s in this industry.
There was a company in Bristol that did that, and I'm trying to remember. Oh, I won't say their name because I don't think I can remember the full name properly. But they had a problem with some of the team were brilliant at BD and some of the team were brilliant at resourcing. And I remember going for an interview with them, and they were going through this revolution, and their managers were going through this absolute epiphany of revolution. Why the fuck are we doing 360 model? Let's turn everyone into 180s. Let's get people going out and representing the business and dragging in the business for us and just get people to fill the business, and we'll manage it somehow in the in-between. And that's where they were. And they were trying to place them people in their business that fitted into this jigsaw puzzle. And if you're a 360 person, you can be the go-between. Great. They will train you to do that. But otherwise, it will be your BD person or your resourcer. Which one do you want to be? And I saw that as a really good map for when I grow.
It's what one of my big clients does, Mark. My biggest client, they're someone I work with a lot, and they have a delivery team and a sales team. Now, some people do 360. Often the delivery team is where everyone starts, and to get into the sales team, you have to be promoted into it.
Yeah. I think, and David, you hit the nail on the head. The exact word you need to use there: promoted into it. In other words, it's a step up. It's not a slide across into the BD team. It's a different venture. It's a different methodology of working.
I think this is the thing. People don't have to go. This is what I see with my big clients. So there are people that just want to do delivery or. Maybe they want to grow into a more account manager role. And that's fair enough. And they provide the career paths to do that. So some of the delivery people make more than some of the sales people.
Yeah.
Because there are delivery guys there that will resource 10 placements a month, 15, 20, 30 placements a month sometimes.
Yes.
They've got an insane candidate pool, which means the sales guys can just go and that they have to work together well. Because I said it before, it's all about marketing the candidate. So a delivery team person comes over to me with a candidate and says, I really think you want to market this candidate to this, this, and this.
Give it
a shot. Because it teaches the delivery team to be more commercially aware. Like, the one thing that's needed now to be successful in recruitment is commercial awareness about your industry.
100%. I agree. Totally agree. You don't have to come from the industry, but you do need to be very aware of that industry.
Exactly.
And how it works. But you said about account managers, someone can become naturally account manager. They tend to be the top billers anyway, because if they've become account manager through growing their business, that's kind of where they end up as an account manager.
Exactly.
And I always say account managers make great internal recruiters. That's my that's my perspective.
Definitely.
Always true. So the future of recruitment is not as similar as it is today. There is a defined difference then, would you say?
Yeah, there's lots of opportunities. More people are going to start one-man bands and lifestyle businesses. It's more accessible to do that. And there's going to be more importance of marketing. And to be fair, Mark, I'm pretty lucky. There's probably going to be more importance of training to businesses.
Oh, I totally agree. I think that's what's in vogue at the moment. Years ago, it was like, oh, we've got to have a really shit-hot CRM, and it was job boards, and then it was, you know, fax machine disappearing, and the emails were becoming the thing. And lately, it's video interviewing. Have you noticed that surge in this thing coming through? I think all the trainers are very vocal on social media and very visible on social media. And I think because of that, there's going to be more focus on training and development, because to be a professional at anything, you've still got to have a coach. You've still got to have a trainer. You've still got to have someone to push you, someone behind you to make sure you're at the peak of what you do day to day.
I think that it's probably the biggest irony in the recruitment industry is everyone knows the recruitment industry is quite insidious, particularly at a high level. People know everyone.
Yeah.
The trainers all tend to like each other. Like, we're all friends.
Yes.
you rarely see it within the L&D community that we're slagging off another person that's involved. Yeah. Because a lot of trainers are there because they really enjoy watching people grow.
Yeah, you guys have got your own Facebook group, haven't you?
Exactly. L&D 2.0, Hannah Keep and Sid Barnes. And that is where we come together and we talk. But we talk in a very nice way.
Yeah, I suspect you guys swap stories and ideas and thought processes and develop kind of...
Exactly. So you might talk about challenges that happen in the industry, like how much should L&D do versus how much should managers do. But yeah, I mean, it's a very forward-thinking community of people that want to work together.
Yeah, yeah. That's really good. That we didn't have that 10 years ago. No one had that 10 years ago.
No one really spoke like 10 years ago, I think.
Well, I remember internal trainers when I was at Reed, you know, they would go off and become external trainers. And it was like, oh, look at them going off and becoming an external trainer. And it was like, no, but that's a good thing. They now have enough information and knowledge to go and do it for themselves. I find it fascinating that 10 years ago they didn't really see it like that. Now you guys are tight as anything. You see.
Yeah. And I think this thing is companies are very open to using external trainers. I feel quite happy because it's enough for all of us to go around. And we will, even before now. So now I can actually make money from it in the sense of I can contract in a trainer for a particular thing, pay them well, and I'll still make GP from it. But before, I still used to like recommend people informally, and people would say to me, I'd be in a conversation with a client and they'd say, oh, I'm speaking to this person. And I might say, oh, I don't know that person very well, but Hannah Keeper you're talking to, she's really good.
I really like Hannah. Actually.
Yeah. She's like, and this is the thing, that would happen in a lot of conversations where we would say, oh yeah, this person's actually really good. You should speak to them as well.
Yeah. Oh, I know I said that was the last question about the future recruitment, right? But I've got one last question. Have you seen the old school trainers and where they've ended up today? And what I mean is, and I'm going to completely leave this question, I have seen some certain old school trainers that I used to know from before the recession. I don't know why I draw this line, the recession, as like this moment of...
Oh, it did change everything, to be fair, Mark.
It did, didn't it? And now they are doing this game of email marketing systems. And do you know the ones I'm on about?
They're sort of building sales funnels.
Yeah, it's weird. It's strange, and it doesn't make fucking sense to me. But
you know what? I will say this, like, the recruitment industry is going that way, and look, some of them can mess up with their sales funnels and approaches, but it's kind of what I explained in terms of Facebook ads. And in some ways, I'm surprised that they got on board first before other people did. Yeah. This should be like someone like me or one of the younger marketing guys coming out saying building sales funnels. But it's not. It's a load of recruitment trainers that have got experience like 20, 30 years ago. Recruitment when I was born.
But I think they did it the wrong time. They got on it too early. I think they were pioneers in the sense that they saw the future. But when they got on it, I mean, I'm not going to name one of them because it frustrates me if I name him. Mm. But he sent me tons of emails over a course of, it still does, but it's all in my junk mail. I've tried GDPR-wise, I tried to get off his mailing list and still won't take me off there. And I'm thinking this aggressive technique of poorly written, poorly grammared emails is what he's selling. Is that systematized?
I think this is the thing, though. To put this into context, Mark, within the online marketing space, what's happened is these guys have all gone to similar events at a similar time. And they've been told about how useful sales funnels are. Unfortunately, you're right. They probably got onto it at the wrong time. Like, the online marketing space is a little bit ahead of the recruitment industry in terms of marketing tools being utilized.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's fair enough. And that's how the world kind of works, is you get the sort of techies doing it massively before everyone else, then it kind of filters to other industries. So yeah, unfortunately these guys have invested in probably similar people that have told them to do one thing, they've not really got new context for it.
The theory in which they've pushed, we're going to have a landing page and then someone's going to subscribe to it and then you've got a list of people you can start selling at. That theory is great. But in order to drive people to this one place, the landing page, you've got to have a huge sphere of influence in social media land or on the internet or pay a lot of money in SEO to drive people to this landing page. And in
Definitely.
The, you just in the end you discover actually it's not that fucking good. It's not.
I think this is the thing. Like, it's really useful, but you're right. It's not put into the context. Like, when I was saying about Facebook adverts, I'm using exactly the same systems and funnels and principles that the people you're thinking of are using.
Yeah.
But I'm saying up front, I'm going to spend probably £1,000 a month to do it. So it's going to cost me £12. Before I really see any tangible results. And it's also why, like, when I say to companies about content, marketing and funnels, there is a place for them, but it's not replaced the phone yet. And
It's not replaced the phone. It's not replaced good specking into companies and developing relationships with companies and stuff like that. It's not replaced any of that. I tell you what you need to do if you want to go down this route and you don't want to spend £2,000-£3,000. You need to be really good at social media and push social media as a content place.
Definitely.
Some great people doing that right now as well.
Yeah, even then, I still think it all works well in partnership. Like, if you're really going to go for aggressively scaling, you need to put money into things.
Yeah.
Like social media. Like, and Facebook isn't a quick thing. It's not you spend £1,000 and suddenly it fixes all of your problems.
No.
You have to be spending that sort of, £10,000-£12,000 a year at a minimum if you can utilize that form of strategy.
This is it. And this is what I say about content marketing. You're not going to start making money from content marketing in the first, I would say, probably 12 months. Really?
Yeah,
properly.
Exactly.
After 12 months, you'll start seeing changes and differences. And this is the conversation I have with people. Cold calling isn't dead. Cold calling now is one part of a probably 15, 20 different bits of processes you're now going to do.
100%. This is the problem, Mark. In 5 years' time, if someone's not done the content marketing and they've not started now, they're not going to exist.
Oh, 100%. Oh, mate. There's people on social media right now, they've never written a blog. There's businesses have never written a blog, and I don't care you as a consultant, as long as you're making money and you haven't got a depreciation of that money over time, then continue what you're doing. But be aware, if you're not doing these things that other companies are doing, they're going to overtake you, because this is the direction, this is the future, this is how it's coming about.
It's why, Mark, I've got 2 days to sit and go through a load of content, to speak to my content writers. I'll probably keep my stuff out so I can film some videos as well.
Yes, do it. That's all I gotta say. And I think to some extent, though, some people shouldn't do it. They should get someone to help them to do it at first.
Always go for expertise. I think this is where old school people go wrong, is they will hire someone who's done marketing at university and pay them 20 grand a year. Yes. Whereas I'll go and pay someone $1,000 or $2,000 for a day.
Yeah.
And then I'll go and pay someone 20 grand a year to implement what that person told me. You have to pay in experts for this stuff.
I was very close this year. I've kind of gone down a different direction, but I might resurrect the plan still. I was very close this year of creating a either a package or a development tool or something to teach agencies to utilize online marketing better, including how to write better videos and how to film videos as well on top of that. I think it's needed now. I think it is.
It's something that we're going to offer as a service.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like 100%. And me and my dad talk about it, because my dad's really into it as well. Like, that's what I love about him as an old recruiter. So forward thinking.
I don't think Jeff is an old school recruiter. I think Jeff is a modern recruiter, but always has moved with the times as well.
I think there might have been like scenes from Wolf of Wall Street that he's experienced live.
Yes.
And knowing him, he's probably driven that sort of behaviour.
Yeah.
I think in the 80s, he would have been a stereotype of an 80s salesperson. In the 90s, he would have been the same. 90s. But he's always upgraded it, and he's always changed towards where the market has been. And yeah,
he's just a really flexible businessman. That's what he is.
Yeah, exactly. Really flexible. And this is the problem with certain old school dinosaur recruiters, is they're very inflexible.
And they're dying out very fast at the moment.
Exactly.
I've seen 3 in the last 5 years disappear off the face of social media and never to return again.
Exactly. And it's only a matter of time before one and his little bloody organisation is banned, they're completely discredited.
Yeah.
Because the information they have is resonant of the 1990s. The marketplace has changed.
Yeah, definitely. And on that note, Ben, thank you very much for this. We've had a good natter for over an hour.
Yes, certainly have.
At the start of this, we were thinking, how much are we going to talk about? We talk about everything, which is great.
I know. That's been amazing, Mark. Thank you so much.
No, thank you. Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. And we will speak soon. Take it easy, mate.
Cheers, Mark. Thank you.
Well, I'm glad you reached this far. It's quite a long podcast, that. But as you can tell, Ben and I are very passionate about training and development. I'm not even a trainer. I don't even do any of that anymore. Well, I used to when I was a business manager back in the day. But it's one of those things I'm passionate about. I think to advance your business forward, to develop your business and make it profitable and make it move into the 21st century deeper and deeper and survive things like Brexit, you've got to train and develop your staff. It's crucial. It's up there with selling your product, wherever that is. So engage with people like Ben. There's a few other guys out there as well. I'm sure Ben will point you in their direction if he can't help. And also, if you're looking for other kind of support and ideas and development, definitely speak to Ben about that as well. Ben's got some great connections. His dad, Jeff, gave me some brilliant advice not so long ago as well. So he's well connected. He's got a lot of great things, and I'm really looking forward to his podcast coming up. So I can't wait to hear them. But yeah, thank you very much for listening this far. I've got a couple of great podcasts coming up in the next couple of weeks. One which I'm really looking forward to. I'm recording this week, so listen out for that one. Take care. Bye bye.